This is Gareth Southgate, and this is the Three Lions Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Three Lions podcast. My name is Russell Osborne and this is an independent England football supporters podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. Hope I find you well. Now, since May 2021, I've been doing the occasional series looking at all of our England managers from people who know them best. We began with Walter Winterbottom back then. I only managed to get two out last year, which was a little frustrating, so I'm hoping to catch up some more this year. But I hope you can appreciate that they do take a little bit of research. All the ones that I've previously done to date, well, they can all be found at your podcast provider of choice or threelionspodcast.com. Now, to date, there have been 15 full-time England managers. That excludes the caretakers, and I'll worry about them another time. But this episode is dedicated to England's eighth manager. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Three Lions podcast as we continue our England Managers series. Guardian writer, Jacob Steinberg. Hello, Jacob.
Hi.
You well?
All good, thank you.
Cool. Now, you helped Glenn Hoddle write his 2021 autobiography, Playmaker. And I mean this in the nicest of ways, one of the easiest books I've read.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it.
That's really enjoyable. This from an Arsenal supporter as well.
Well, obviously a big rivalry there. So
there is, yeah. What's Glenn like as a person to work with?
Glenn as a person is away from what he's like to work with. He's just a lovely guy, really. Really interesting. Very kind. In terms of what he'd like to, and you know, absolutely, obviously, football obsessed as well, and really interesting to always talk to on the game. That was, you know, one of the great parts of doing that. Obviously, was, you know, talking to somebody who's got so much knowledge and insight into football and seeing so much. And then in terms of what he was like to work with. You couldn't really ask for someone better to ghostwrite in terms of how, you know, just in terms of how he sort of really approached it, because he was just so invested in the project and wanted it to be, wanted the book to be, you know, basically as perfect as it could be. So, you know, there was very, very long sessions with him, you know, hours and hours at times. I can't remember how many we did in the end, but you know, we absolutely made sure absolutely everything was as he wanted it to be. Even, you know, down to little words here and there to change. So, you know, it was in terms of just the project from my perspective, you couldn't have any complaints over, you know, the amount of material provided, but also the love and attention from his end that went into it. You know, it wasn't something that he approached, you know, with sort of a half-hearted, unfocused attitude. It was, you know, fully dialed into it. And you know, that makes it when you're actually sitting down to put it on the page, it makes it way easier, obviously, when, you know, someone's gone to such you know, great lengths and made sure as well, if he's maybe sort of some things were obviously happened a while ago, and so obviously you sort of struggle to remember certain bits at times. So, you know, going back and talking to people just to sort of, did that happen like that, or was it like that? And you know, it was and then we'll come back and just sort of clarify something as well. So it was a pleasure to work with him.
Yeah. No, there's a lot within the pages that just tells the whole story from right from the beginning to, let's say, right up to his recent incident at BT Sport, which no doubt we'll get to. No, it's going to be impossible to cover everything. So as this is an England podcast, we'll concentrate on his two major periods with England. Obviously, if people want to find out more, then the book is there to be read. But I'll begin just by saying he was born in Hayes in West London, 1957. And at aged four, he moved and grew up in Harlow in Essex. And I only mention this because it's 7-8 miles down the road from me. I know Harlow quite well. And it's such a contradiction to some of the places that he later went on to play in. Basically, I'm saying sort of Monaco in France, the differences between Harlow and there. But it sort of raised a smile with me. But I want to sort of fast forward quite a few years to an incident that maybe people maybe won't know about, that maybe his football career maybe wouldn't even got off the ground by playing cricket, where a cricket ball hit him in the eye and there was a possibility of him losing his sight, wasn't there?
There was, yeah. And obviously it was very, very close to that happening. A few inches in it, I think. And just one of those sort of what if moments, because obviously he wouldn't have been playing football if that had happened, and we would probably never have heard of him. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's one of Tottenham's greatest ever players, one of the best English talents, and it was just a stroke of luck, really. And he obviously was in hospital for quite a long time with what happened and recovering. Obviously, it sounded, in terms of the recovery, just sounded really kind of mind numbing because of the post care. And yeah, he's had. I mean, there are little bits in the book where he sort of does talk about just those little near misses that he had, where obviously, as you mentioned, where he's ultimately where it comes to, where he has the cardiac arrest while he's working for BT Sport, and those little moments in your life, which you know, obviously the cardiac arrest was one thing, but the cricket incident was just a freak accident and almost basically changes his life irrevocably. Yeah. But instead he got away with it and goes on to have amazing life and career in football.
Absolutely, a amazing career. 16, he signed apprentice forms with Tottenham and became part of the team there at White Hart Lane. 75, he makes his debut for Spurs. There was a piece there that I read in a game that he played for Spurs. It was the semi-final of the Cup in 1981 against Wolves, where I read it and I thought, actually, this sort of correlates to later on in his life, where sort of the spiritual side of him comes in, where he says that he was taking a free kick in this particular game, the FA Cup semi-final. And he said he floated away from the stadium to almost sort of look down and have a conversation with himself about what he was doing at the time. So kind of when he fast forward, it's maybe not such a surprise that later events that his sort of his feelings and thoughts are.
I mean, I can't speak for him on that. I think maybe with the Wolves one, that might have... I can't quite remember, to be honest, but I wouldn't have been putting words in his mouth, because he obviously went through everything, obviously. But I think on that, to be honest, I think he's more sort of talking about the creative side of his game and sort of giving that insight into just how he was able to come up with the things that he did on the pitch, and just that being able to see things that maybe other players other players couldn't, and being able to work it out and sort of working on instinct, and you know, that Wolves goal was, I think, you know, is a famous goal in obviously in Tottenham history, certainly for older supporters. And I think it's sort of talking, you know, on that front, it was when we were talking about it was more sort of I think it was more kind of talking about just those split seconds where, you know, you have, where you're standing over a penalty or a free kick, or you've got that split second to make a pass or a chance on goal. And just that ability that certain players have and that certain players don't. And he had it, you know, it's just this ability to see things that others didn't. And for him, that's how it kind of, the experience was, and why he was able to do the things he did on the pitch.
Yeah. Well, he ultimately, as we mentioned, joined Monaco, where he hooked up with a certain Arsene Wenger, who he appeared to have a fantastic relationship with, and who taught him quite a lot.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he'd had a few little moments where he could have left Tottenham, and he'd always, as you know, as he talks about, he'd always been very attracted to the idea of playing abroad. I think it was Napoli that was close, particularly at some point in the 80s. And then when it eventually came to it with Tottenham, where he'd been there for such a long time, and eventually he was coming towards just wanting that fresh challenge, and finally getting that taste of the European game, which obviously sort of really just attracted a player like him and really appealed to him. And he was close, and it was PSG that he was initially close to joining, and instead in come Monaco, he just sort of gets that last minute chat from the agent, you know, let's go and have a conversation. And he goes and meets this guy, Arsene Wenger, who obviously in 1986, probably not, well, nowhere near the figure that he came to be, as you know, as we all know, Arsene who, when he took over at Arsenal, you know, he wasn't really known in this country, despite what he actually did achieve in France. And yeah, and obviously he goes to talk to Arsene Wenger, and obviously the attraction of playing in Monaco as well, and meets a guy who just sort of gives him a different, a new lease of life. There wins the title, playing amazing football in a slightly different, freer position than he would have been playing in England. And you know, it's interesting how he would talk about how Wenger would always actually tell him that he, you know, every time he come back from international duty, it would always felt like a waste, and that, you know, he sort of having to be playing way more defensively than he should have been. And but there's, you know, some of the stories at Monaco were, you know, great. Obviously played with Mark Hatley, but there's that, you know, there's that story about how he comes into training one day and George Weah is in the dressing room, yeah, but he's just a trialist and they don't know who he is. And he didn't he sort of sat with Glenn and I think Hatley, and because he spoke a bit of English, and so they sort of helped him out a bit. They weren't really sure, and then the game starts, and the training starts, and like, oh my god, this guy is absolutely incredible, and obviously quite raw and everything as well. I think it was because Glenn had injury problems when he was at Monaco, and he, I think it's that bit where. I think this is right. I'm trying to remember stuff from it, but
yeah,
where when he was out, the way I was, you know, like what do I do without Glenn on the pitch, basically? Because he would sort of at that time, you know, he wasn't, he, you know, he was learning. He was a young player who was very inexperienced, and Glenn obviously was a very good guide. But yeah, the Monaco years were fantastic for him, and playing with Wenger, obviously. Actually, you know, ends up being, it's a, you know, but they certainly obviously end up managing against each other, but they're very close subsequently to that, still friends and been still talk and everything. So you know, those football kindred spirits, I'd say.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned the national team, the England national team. As a player, by the time he was at Monaco, he'd sort of almost accrued all his England caps by then. He played 53 times for England, which he was on the winning side 27 times, drew 11 and lost 5. His first game for England was against Bulgaria in 1979. It was a game that had been postponed 24 hours earlier because of fog. I believe England won 2-0. He set up Dave Watson to score the opener and then scored the second himself with a volley.
Yeah, a friendly. And he said that it was quite like his goal against Stoke on his debut. But you'd hope, I mean, you would obviously he'd already started making a name for himself. And in 1979, obviously as you well know, the England team had gone through a really rough patch in terms of qualification for World Cups, just missed out on the previous two, but doing so while actually, you know, English sides in Europe were doing really well. And obviously as well, there were, if you actually, you look through the players that they had, you know, there's a lot of talent there. It's not like it was a bad collection of players, but, you know, he was one who was coming in and obviously exciting, because of his form for Tottenham, and you know, a young player coming into the side and comes in and scores on his debut. And you could kind of imagine that if that's, something that was to happen now, you imagine there'd be like, you know, probably never get out the team. But obviously he goes on and just struggles to nail down a place and a manager who ever really seemed to trust him.
Because he played just under Ron Greenwood and Bobby Robson. And there was a part in the book where I've written it down here. He says, I always fought against the tide when I played for England. There was never a coach who truly trusted me. Rude Hullett told him that he'd been born in the wrong country. And probably much like Arsene Wenger was saying to him, any other country would have really appreciated him more.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the most, that was one of the absolutely best sessions that we have where we were talking about it, and he was talking about his football philosophy. And, you know, and we're talking about things that happened in the 1970s and 1980s, and just sort of angered, you could tell the anger that came through, not in terms of just how he felt that he wasn't appreciated, but just also at the time how kind of backwards, I guess, the English way of playing was, and the approach to football, and how, even though they had, as I say, you go through the names, and there's a lot of very good players there, and creative players as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's not like they weren't producing players, but it was the way that the way they would have sort of approached the games, and 4-4-2, and it would be kind of long ball and do that focus, and they would just get picked off by smarter teams, basically. And that was just his frustration that came through. And yeah, I mean, there were lots of, you know, the Rude Hullett one, obviously, and Wenger, people saying, you know, like, you know, you should have been appreciated like Platini was for Juventus, for France, and obviously Platini was playing at the same time, during that period, wins the Euros with France in 1984, at a point where, you know, where England is sort of just frustrating all the time.
Yeah.
So, he just felt like whenever he was there, it was, you know, just lumbered with defensive duties that meant, you know, he wasn't able to fully express himself, and played in certain ways that, you know, if you played on the right wing, then you kind of be, you know, tracking back or whatever, and doing things that weren't ultimately going to bring necessarily the best out of you. And you know, did he ever really play? Did he ever really get a chance as a number 10? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, for him, it was just that frustration. I think the one game where he does play as a number 10. And he does really well. I think off the top of my head, I think it's a friendly against Hungary, I believe. And then just doesn't get another chance after that. So yeah, I'm not sure the trust was there. I mean, look, maybe I'm not really sort of here sort of fighting his corner because I wasn't alive for these yeah. games. So I don't know, but maybe there'll be people who say that, well, when he did play for England, he didn't do it, or there'll be managers, obviously the manager at the time may well have argued that they wanted to go in a different way, and they could give you a convincing argument as to why others were more suited, or why they didn't feel that he was the right one. But that was his viewpoint. And it's interesting, I think, that there are obviously people like Ruud Gullit, who was obviously in that great Dutch side in that period, and who felt that he was just not appreciated, and obviously that he speaks about Wenger, you know, come back from international duty, let's say, and it would just be like the same conversation, you know, just like, you know, paraphrasing, but you know, another waste of time. But yeah, I mean, there's this one where Wenger would go, and he sort of talked about Wenger was just baffled by the way that England played, and he sort of told Glenn that he went to a game, watched England, and just came away saying they're just so rigid and not flexible, doesn't suit you, basically. So yeah, just a massive frustration for him at that point. You know, he talks about how he just sort of felt like actually one of the missed opportunities for him may have been if Brian Clough had got the job. It's interesting as well that the first manager he had was Ron Greenwood. If you think about it, Ron Greenwood, probably most famous for his management of West Ham, yeah. and the West Ham way in the 60s, and you know, playing great attacking football was, you know, kind of what they were known for, being a bit kind of unreliable, soft, and they won a couple of trophies but were always pretty inconsistent in the league, but you know, they were known for the West Ham way and everything, but actually it never really clicked between them, which, you know, you kind of, again, you look at as a bit of a missed opportunity. So yeah, I mean, he played a lot for Bobby Robson, but again, just never really kind of properly clicked for him under Robson.
Yeah, well, much like yourself, I don't really remember his playing days for England. Is sort of more him as a manager where I sort of remember him, and which once his playing days were over, that was where he sort of found himself. Swindon came along and Chelsea came along, and then sort of England, he was touted as England manager, which came as he said, he became England manager as soon as Andras Möller scored his penalty in the 96 semi-final. And what did he say about how the England job came about? Because there's moments where he was sort of alongside Terry Venables in what sort of seems to be a bit of an uncomfortable situation.
I mean, you know, obviously he came in sort of before the Euros to kind of have a bit of an awkward meet and greet, and there's that awkward press conference where he was being announced. It was interesting because he hadn't won anything at Chelsea, but we're not talking about the Chelsea of Abramovich, no. Or even kind of. He sort of got the ball rolling at Chelsea, but he was under a lot of pressure at the start. He didn't start incredibly well there, but he didn't sort of take over an incredibly good situation. And, you know, he left Swindon having just got them up and went to Chelsea. So he'd done a fantastic job at Swindon, getting them into the Premiership, as it was known at the time, and then goes to Chelsea, but quite under a lot of pressure, I guess, relatively there because of, you know, he's a Tottenham legend, and everything. So when he started badly, that was sort of something that was going to be held against him. But you know, they kind of got through that period to get to gets them to that FA Cup final. They have a bit of a run in Europe the next season, but with a pretty kind of moderate squad. Like you go through the squad, there's no real kind of stars in it at all, and But they had at the time, Ken Bates was the owner, along with Matthew Harding, and Matthew Harding's putting in money at the time. And the thing that flips the switch, I guess, is Ruud Gullit, and sort of like puts them on the path to being that cosmopolitan Chelsea. And so that's kind of, I guess, and Glenn obviously was massive in getting Gullit to come there. But you know, he hadn't really sort of, I guess, if you were sort of taking the equivalent at now, if like Southgate was to leave, and you would take the equivalent job that Glenn was doing now at Chelsea, I don't know, like people would be saying, you've got to get him in, unless it was kind of, well, actually Glenn Hoddle's like a, you know, play great football and he's an England legend, let's get him in. So as he's, you know, at the time, he, as he says, it was a shock when he gets the initial meeting with the FA. It kind of comes out the blue. And obviously everything that had gone on with Venables at the time, which meant that he was having to leave the job, and someone else is taking over after the Euros. And obviously at the time, I mean, no one knew exactly what was going to happen there.
Yeah.
And Venables' reputation probably by the end of the Euros, but I'm guessing, you know, no one really would have wanted him to go, but there you go. That's what was happening. And so Glenn comes into that situation, you know, taking over, you know, is it a point where, you know, you're not taking over after a wretched campaign as Venables was. He's actually taking over a really popular, quite successful team with the feel good factor really, really high. So it's a different kind of pressure, to, I guess, well, the kind of thing that like Southgate would have faced, where he was taking over the team at an all-time low. You know, this was the highest England team had been for years, basically.
Yeah. Well, he became England manager, say, as soon as that penalty was scored in the semi-final. But his first game as manager, as manager, actually, he took charge of 28 England games, which he won 17, drew 6, lost 5. His first one was away to Moldova, a game I remember. I wasn't there, but I remember where I watched it. A game that they introduced David Beckham.
Yes, Beckham makes his debut, and Beckham's obviously, it's just at that point, he'd had sort of the breakthrough season the year before, but the breakthrough moment, obviously, as I'm sure we've all watched the documentary, but the breakthrough moment of the start of that season, where he obviously scores the goal against Wimbledon. But actually, something that he mentions is that he'd actually tried to sign Beckham on loan. He tried to get into Chelsea on loan from United, but was very much told where to go by Sir Alex Ferguson. And that, you know, that wasn't going to happen. Beckham went on loan to Preston instead in what was the first division. He brings in Beckham, but also, you know, you look at it, Nick Barmby. Barmby scores in that game as well. Barmby had been in the Euro 96 squad, but hadn't really played. Well, I mean, Venables didn't really sort of make many changes. And Barmby was a young player at Middlesbrough, wasn't he, at the time?
Yeah.
Can't remember if he'd gone to Everton by that point, but he starts and scores in that game. Obviously, Shearer does, I think, as well. But he's made little tweaks at the start of it straight away. You know, such as bringing in Beckham, he gives the captaincy to Alan Shearer, which I guess, you know, some people might have thought, you know, should the striker be captain? But he felt Glenn's point was that actually at international level, it would help if your most famous player, which was, I guess, at the time Shearer, is the captain. Kind of help. He felt it would help with referees and everything. I guess when we come to the Argentina game, you might say, well, maybe it didn't help that much.
Yeah.
But you know, there was obviously as well the tweak in the style that he brought in as well. Just the formation change. He moves to the back three wing backs, which was quite in vogue at the time. And Venables had obviously sort of he played back four predominantly at the Euros, the famous Christmas tree formation. But Glenn slightly changed it and brought in a different style, which was good for some players and bad for others. It was like, as he talked about, like, for example, it was bad for Steve McManaman, who'd been a massive player, obviously, at the Euros, but actually was completely despite still being a really good player for Liverpool, was basically found no real place for him in the 98 World Cup. I can't even remember if McManaman, I assume he went, but he barely played. He really didn't have that much of a role under Hoddle at all. I mean, he was kind of, you know, usurped by Beckham and Scholes really as well.
Well, that World Cup qualifying sort of culminated in, I don't know if it'd be fair to say his highlight as England manager was that 0-0 in Rome.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they'd had the disappointment against, obviously they'd lost at home to Italy. So they'd won the first few games. And he talks about, one of the things he talks about, which I think he's quite proud of, is the fact that obviously Venables had a home Euros. And this isn't to take anything away from Venables, but obviously they had to qualify. As 96, they didn't have to qualify. They played every game at Wembley as well. But Glenn had to, you know, suddenly took over a team that hadn't really gone through any of that. They'd been playing friendly for 2 years and then obviously gone into this home Euros as well. So they didn't have the experience of going to places such as Moldova and Georgia, who were in their group. And Moldova obviously were a very limited team, but still, you know, not a easy, comfortable place to go as such. Whereas Georgia were a little bit more tricky. And he's quite like, when they went to the away game, for example, in Georgia, he was really proud of this performance. Talks about it in quite great detail about how he used he didn't have Alan Shearer for that game, he was injured, but he kind of used David Batty and Paul Ince as kind of blockers in midfield, basically. And he thought Batty was a really underrated player, much better passer than people thought he was, to kind of just basically stop Kinkladze, who was the danger player. Because he said, yeah, like, they looked at them and they thought that Georgia were a really, really creative side, but they just shut them down and just delivered this quite mature, tactically clever performance, which, you know, English sides hadn't always been known for over the years. And the thing about Glenn was that he was probably more kind of pragmatic than you might have imagined he would be as a manager, you know, playing the back three and doing things like that in certain games. But that was an element of taking, like, trying to make England more smart on the international stage. And ultimately it culminates in performances like that against Georgia, where they're very, very controlled, but they've got the ability to, you know, good players up front. You know, Gazza was obviously still in the team at that point. And it culminates in that really, really mature performance against Italy, where they'd obviously lost the first game. You know, infamously starts Matt Le Tissier instead of Les Ferdinand. I think he felt that Les would be, Ferdinand would be kind of just marked too tightly by the Italian defenders. Like, it would be something they'd just be used to, as good a player as Ferdinand was, whereas Le Tissier would be, you know, something different that they wouldn't have anticipated and wouldn't know how to handle. And Tissier has that chance, which might have changed it, but he doesn't take it and then never plays for England again.
Yes.
But it comes into that Italy game where before that, obviously they'd gone to Le Tournoi and and had beaten Italy 2-0, which felt like a really kind of big developmental point for that team, because Italy have obviously, I guess partly, you know, the fact that like Channel 4 had Italian football, so we kind of knew who all the players were, and it felt very intimidating. And there were some players over in England as well who were some of the best players in the division, like Zola, and, you know, we'd sort of the best, like Juventus were the best team. And so that, you know, winning that game against Italy in the summer was a really big thing for them. Especially, I think, against that night against them again, I think Shearer doesn't play against Italy in the Tournoi game. It's Ian Wright, who he loved as a striker. But the other big thing was, like, he gets a goal from Paul Scholes, who he absolutely just raves about as how clever he was, what brilliant, just brilliant footballer Paul Scholes was, and absolutely adored him. And he brings him in, you know, someone again who can kind of giving them that, that something a little bit different. And it comes ultimately into that game against Italy where, you know, they're just so disciplined and they just play so clever against such a difficult side in Rome as well, where it's such an intimidating night as well. And really, I mean, I haven't watched it back fully, but if you look at the highlights, they sort of really don't, they do a job on Zola, who was the danger man, and make sure that he can't do anything as he did in the first game. And then, they have chances here and there. And then obviously the Ian Wright moment, and for Glenn, he talks about how obviously Vieri goes, they go down the other end and Vieri, and he thinks it's in from his angle, the header.
Heart in mouth.
And then he has this, and like he has the heart in mouth, but actually he feels like he has like basically some kind of cardiac event, basically. Yes. Because he was like in this massive, massive sweat, a weird kind of sweat basically afterwards, just because it meant so much, I guess. I don't know, but he wasn't sure, but I think he had to get it checked out. But yeah, that's kind of what I guess the job did to him in a certain way. It's an amazing story that he tells about that and that moment. And I think he sort of said he didn't ever really feel properly right for quite a bit of time after that. In terms of his health, who knows if the two? I doubt it, but who knows? But obviously, then has the near death experience. What, like 25 years later or however long it was, you know, they get that draw after this just sort of performance that wasn't again one that you might have necessarily associated with England. I mean, you could associate obviously the backs to the wall kind of element to it, and you know, there's that the image, I guess, that people take from that night is Paul Ince with the bloody head and everything in the bandage, because it's like that never say die element to it. And obviously there was that to it, because you had to have that defensive ability to withstand and personality to withstand that environment against that Italy team. But they wouldn't have got the point they needed if they weren't able to play in a tactically intelligent way, and obviously that comes from the manager and the changes that, you know, he felt that he was bringing in. It was a real kind of, again, just a real big, really big step for that team, I think, at the time, and gets them to the World Cup. And obviously even that was a huge moment, because obviously they hadn't qualified for the previous one, and hadn't had to qualify for the Euros, and again, you know, qualification was you know, for younger people, I think that qualification now just seems like whatever. I mean, obviously 2014 in the Euros, World Cup, there's England just cruised through now, but back then actually it was really, really difficult. The tournaments weren't as big, and the groups could be harder, and it was much more of an event. It was kind of more on a knife edge. It was a huge moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, we don't realize how lucky we are until we start to look back. Interestingly, I spoke with Gary Lewin, who obviously fixed up Paul Ince that you mentioned there with his bloody head. That was an interesting conversation that I had with him. But yeah, I mean, once we'd qualified for the World Cup, it was here now that sort of other events were going to sort of ramp up as being part of England manager and all that is entailed with that. England had a couple of sort of warm-up games, but it's now that we get to sort of the squad and the Gaza incident. But it's important to sort of realise that whilst we all know what happened with Gaza, Glenn had been sort of keeping an eye on him and sort of really noticing that perhaps injuries and his attitude weren't as they should be in sort of that period between Italy away and he fully intended to wanted to take him, but on sort of on the other
he
hand,
wanted to give him every chance, but but you know, it was ultimately working with somebody who ultimately wasn't going to give themselves that chance. It was difficult to get through to for the message to get through to him, and ultimately it came to a head. And I guess the problem ultimately for Gazza was that that actually in his place England had Paul Scholes, who we've
already mentioned,
playing for, you know, by that point had properly established himself in the best team, you know, give or take Arsenal. Obviously won the league that year, but obviously the dominant force of English football were Manchester United, and so you've got Paul Scholes there. So actually there was a ready-made replacement for Gazza, and you know, that wouldn't have been the case in Euro 96. It probably would, you know, there wasn't probably someone who could have done that, but by that point Paul Scholes was, well, he was a year away from winning the treble with Manchester United and being one of the most important players to that, even though he didn't play in the final, obviously. So he was able to shift it around. And not only did he have Paul Scholes, and I know that obviously what happened there, but he also had David Beckham, who could come into the central midfield that he was playing. So they weren't reliant. I mean, I've heard people sort of say, you know, how could you do that? You were leaving out the best player, but he wasn't leaving out. I don't think he was leaving out the best player. You know, ultimately, you look at him. I mean, he was very important for them in the qualification campaign, important in, and had a very good game away in Italy. But actually, where was he playing his football at that point? He was in the you know, what is now the Championship with Middlesbrough.
Middlesbrough, yes.
Paul Gascoigne. So, you know, that was the issue. And he gets injured, I think, in one of the warm-up friendlies, in which England didn't really play too well, I think, in those. And there was a lot of negativity around it at the time. But, I mean, really, it's on a purely footballing grounds, I mean, you could easily make the case for it. And also, I mean, just I'm giving my own opinion here, but if you probably think back to it, if he wasn't going to be the starting 11, would he necessarily have been an amazing presence around the camp?
Yes.
And also, you know, it's a, you know, Southgate's, you know, now that, well, the past two tournaments been a squad of 26, hasn't it? That was actually a squad of 22. So you know, you have to be quite ruthless with what you were doing for that squad. It meant they only took one left back in the end, which actually hit them in the Argentina game because Lasso goes off feeling ill, I think.
Well, yeah, let's go to the World Cup. France 98. We were drawn against Colombia, Romania, and Tunisia in the group games. I mean, fairly optimistic going into that, was he?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't play incredibly against Tunisia, but they basically got the job done, and obviously it was big because Scholes. I remember it, that, you know, there's all this controversy, and then Scott about Gascoigne, and then Scholes scores that great goal near
Cracker.
The end. But it was obviously an afternoon game. It was in Marseille, wasn't it? Really hot day.
Very
hot. So it was never really going to be that good. But obviously the big controversy around that game was dropping Beckham. I know Beckham has obviously had his, there's been the documentary where it's, there's been an element of it where there's been a lot of criticism of Glenn within the documentary. I mean, if you sort of go through it, you sort of just felt that the focus wasn't there leading up to it, and that there were elements that weren't quite right. And you know, all the criticism, they won the game, and he loved Beckham and wanted him in his team, and ultimately they're not playing so brilliantly in the next game. Obviously, there's is it Batty or Ince, which one of them gets injured. I think it's Ince, and Beckham comes on and makes a big impact in that game against Romania, which they end up, you know, they shouldn't have lost that game.
Yeah,
I remember him. He said he woke up on the morning of the game with a bad feeling, and they just didn't play. They should have won it, but didn't. And ultimately, you know, play brilliantly against Colombia in the third game, and then ultimately go into the tougher side of the draw because of that defeat to Romania, who ended up losing in the last 16 anyway. I mean, England would have played Croatia in the last 16, which, you know, that was a very good Croatia team, so who knows, but that Croatia team may well have not been quite as good as the Argentina side that England played, and obviously as well, perhaps David Beckham might not have been a Diego Simeone type winding up Beckham in that game as well.
What does he say about the David Beckham moment in that Argentina game?
I mean, the thing is that it doesn't really, it basically, you know, he shouldn't have done it.
Of course.
But Glenn says, between us, we were talking about it. Post just went, it's not a red card, is it? It's basically, he was shocked when the red card comes out. He thought it was going to be a booking. Simeone makes the most of it, cons the ref. The ref makes a bad decision. Beckham's a bit silly for getting wound up. You know, gets completely played by a smarter guy, a more experienced player at the time. You know, there's a lot of things going on in Beckham's head and everything. And they suffer because of it. But, you know, it was a silly thing to do, but it wasn't a red card. And it's not violent conduct. It wasn't a red card. I don't know whether VAR would have, in this then, would have gone against the on-field decision, but it, you know, I think it might have done. It's one of the sort of, they then have to play from two all, where they should have been, you know, Scholes missed the chance to make it 3-1 just before Argentina score that great free kick.
Yeah.
But then he has to adjust basically in the second half, you know, the entire second half against this Argentina side, where they, he sort of gets, manages to, he doesn't, he actually doesn't bring off a, the natural reaction. It's one of the great tactical performances. The natural reaction would have been, right, we've lost Beckham, we need to take off one of the strikers and bring on a midfielder. But he doesn't do it. He switches it round to 4-4-1, basically, more or less. Yeah. I think Scholes goes over to the left. Instant, I think it's that. Or Anderson's playing as well, isn't he? Owen and Shearer basically sort of do shuttle. Sort of shuttle between playing up front and the right wing, basically. And the two of them just do this great, great job. Owen, he keeps Owen on, and Owen obviously was terrifying them. So you're not going to take off Shearer. And you know, basically Owen just keeps Argentina honest, almost having him on the pitch. And there's another run which Owen goes on, but he ends up missing it on his left foot. But they're basically, if you look at that, I've watched that game back. Argentina do not create a chance. The only chance they really make is the one where they sort of, when England have had that goal disallowed, they break up the other end. When the half England team are celebrating the Sol Campbell goal.
Sol Campbell header.
And then there's that, but actually even then, there's that clearance from Anderson, but actually the flag's gone up for offside anyway, so it wouldn't have been a goal. But that's what they did. They basically killed them. They sort of broke them with this amazing performance. England should have won. If VAR was in use in that game, England would have had a penalty in extra time, golden goal, because it's just a clear handball. By an Argentina player, and they just don't really appeal for it. But the ref completely misses it. But that was a penalty, and it was Alan Shearer to take the penalty, and they would have won. But yeah. You know, it's just one of those nights where absolutely everything that could have gone against them goes against them. And by the end of it, I can't quite remember who comes off. But if you look at the penalty takers, like two of the penalty takers are. He brings on Merson.
Merson, yes.
Not for penalties, but he brings on Merson. So Shearer, Owen, Merson. But then the other two penalty takers are
Ince and Batty.
Batty and Ince. Batty's come on. Scholes has gone off. So he's lost Scholes. And it's obviously an era of three subs rather than five. Would you, he had players on the bench. You could have probably come on to take a penalty. But then how do you, you know, Sheringham was on the bench, a few others. How else, you know, could you have done that with 10 men to do what managers sometimes do and bring on the specialist players to take a penalty? I mean, if they conceded again, it's just those what if questions that you have. But and ultimately, you know, they they go out on penalties. But you know, they really felt like they had this chance of winning the World Cup, and ultimately, you know, then you know he obviously writes the book at the time, and things just sort of turn sour. There's the whole, you know, he's got the criticism for Eileen Drury and everything, and the questions over, you know, the complaints that he rejects, feels that he's been unfairly portrayed over his man management and the way he responded to Beckham, and sort of as well, sort of this idea that he didn't like players who weren't as good as he was, which he totally rejects as well. Points to his time at kind of Swindon, you know, well, if that was the case, why would I have done so well there? And it comes to that head ultimately where he makes the where he has the interview with
which was with the Times, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And he talks about that in the book. And probably not for me to talk about. It's probably, you know, one of the worst moments of his life. And ends up losing his job. There are some people who were totally anti-Hoddle and felt that he was, didn't really like the way the team's managed. But there's the other school of thought that he's kind of just this missed opportunity, ultimately, that he left too soon in the job and that it was unfinished business. And that he was, you know, if you think about it, he had Owen coming through, Scholes, Beckham were still very, very young players. He's got, just coming down the track, Gerrard and Lampard and Joe Cole are coming to this side, and they end up obviously Kevin Keegan. It's a disaster. They hire the foreign manager, and actually, what they do is they actually go for two foreign managers, and actually the two foreign managers play quite 4-4-2 football, and they never get the team is always quite unbalanced, and always despite having amazing talent, the midfield's always quite unbalanced, the whole Gerard Lampard question and everything else. And actually look at it and sort of go the way that Glenn set up the side, it was pretty balanced in midfield. You know, he was happy to leave out certain players who didn't quite fit the system, even though they were obviously very talented players who he would have liked to get in there. I mean, the one that really comes to mind is McManaman, but you know, he had other ideas for the way he wanted the team to play. Yeah. It's a tough job
being a manager,
sad story.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sad story in a certain way. But I think, you know, you can kind of look back on that 98 campaign with a certain amount of pride for that performance. And sometimes it's just not meant to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's coming away from that tournament. He was quite, right, we're going straight into qualifying for Euro 2000. He was positive, right, remained positive until everything else came along. And you can read it all in his own words in the book. It's an interesting, it's his side of the story of how the journey ended with England. But, I mean, some of the things that I read that I really felt was that there was so much pressure on him and his family. He found out that his phone had been hacked as well. Someone, we all know it is like the, bar the prime minister, like people say it's the most high pressure job in the country. But when it sort of, when it ended the way it did for him, the way he puts
it's very difficult. It's a very difficult period of his life, and there are perceptions of him, and I'd say there have been points sort of down the years where it's quite easy to sort of fall into the trap of thinking that's the way that he is, and that he's, you know, bigoted person or whatever. But I mean, it's far away from what he is. Mm. And it really hurt him. And the good thing about him is that he's able to kind of move on and take it for what it is. And he's got his way of seeing the world, which allows him to be philosophical about it, shall we say.
Mm.
But obviously it's very hurtful. And it's sad. And when you meet him, I think people who meet, if you meet him, I think you find it very difficult to have a bad word to say about him. It was very, very enjoyable to spend that time doing it with him.
If I cross paths with him, then I hope to come away with the same feelings. But I mean, he got back into football sort of fairly soon afterwards. Managerial jobs came for him, Southampton, or perhaps maybe some of them didn't work out the way that he wanted to. But there was Southampton, there was Tottenham, where sort of heart ruled the head, yeah. I think. And then Wolves.
I mean, he made initial impact at Spurs. He lost Sol Campbell. And I think he just sort of fell out of love with it, really, by the end. And he's kind of, it's one of those things where he's got a career that I think by the end, it was that feeling of, there was a lot of talk around the man management. And there was that feeling of, I think by the end of it at Wolves, and especially at Spurs as well, where it was felt that he wasn't, he's Glenn Hoddle, terrible manager. But I think, for a lot of it, the career, I think it stands the test of time. I think he, wasn't really a disaster anywhere by any means. Some jobs didn't go to plan, but, you can certainly point to achievements that he had in the game. Just sometimes didn't quite go his way. But, I think he was, by the end of it, I think he was, he's looking for something different, and that's what he got. Seems I seems very happy now. So
yeah.
In what he's doing, so that's good.
Well, I mean, one of the things he did do was sort of move into punditry, and we sort of briefly touched on it, where he had a moment at BT Sport, which was quite well documented, that sort of cardiac arrest. Was it his 61st birthday?
It was, I can't remember if it was his 61st or but yeah, it was the whole thing had been planned and some time with the family, and he goes in that day and has the fall and was just extraordinarily lucky to survive. But it kind of comes back to the as he kind of talks about it, comes back to the cricket ball sort of near the eyes, and almost sort of falling out a window when he was a baby and everything. So here he's still here, still with us.
Certainly is.
Still talking about football.
Yeah. And it's a great book. There's so much more to read and learn about him in there. There's some a couple of stories there about the Diamond Lights track with Chris Waddle. There's the Masked Singer. Little stories. They're all very entertaining. So it's a great book. It came out through HarperCollins a couple of years back. Obviously, it's still available in all good bookshops, I guess, and online. Well, about yourself, I know you wrote a book. Was it Mark Boland?
Yeah, I did. Mark Noble's
Noble. Beg your pardon. Sorry, yeah. Mark Noble.
Yeah. Mark Noble. That came out in November 22, just around the World Cup. So yeah, that was to kind of coincide with his retirement. And obviously for me it was a very enjoyable one to do, because West Ham are my team, so I was able just to annoy him for 6 months or whatever, talking about West Ham. Different kind of person to Glenn, but that's a story for another day.
Yeah, another great player though. Any other books on the horizon?
Projects? Not at the moment. We'll see what comes down the track in the future.
Yeah.
Got to get the Euros out of the way first.
Well, what are your thoughts on that?
I would make them very slight favourites along with France, basically. And they, I think it's pretty much, can they, if they play them, can they do it this time? They should have won in, they should have beaten them in Qatar, I think. And it's just getting over the line if they play them. I'm not really sure there's another side, maybe Portugal, but that they should lose to. And it feels like the team just, you know, maybe a little, you've got the couple of notes of concern in defence and that, just that third midfield position here and there. But basically you've got Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham. So best striker in the world, apart from Haaland, best player in the world, maybe. So at the moment, so I think, yeah, they should be, I don't think, it's not some, you know, let's not get into the England expects thing, but it's just a sort of, just a natural state really to think, well, they should really just logically, they've got a great squad. There's a lot of other teams would say, can they deal with Mbappe? Let's see.
I was just wondering, would a Glenn Hoddle of 1985, 86 get into the current England team?
He is certain that he would. So
yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Jacob, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. As I say, the book Glenn Hoddle, his autobiography, Playmaker, available to read. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
My many thanks go to Jacob there, Jacob Steinberg. He can be found on Twitter at Jacob Steinberg. And the book, Glenn Hoddle, Playmaker, well, that can be found at any good book provider, bookshop, online, book sales place, you know what I mean. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it and maybe learned some things that maybe you didn't know an hour or so ago. Don't forget, you can follow the show on social media. Just search Three Lions Podcast and give it a follow. There's also the Ko-fi account, ko-fi.com/Three Lions Podcast, where you are more than welcome to contribute to the hosting of the podcast. Any amount is gratefully received. I will be back with you very soon, taking a look once again at our England football team. I hope you can join me for it. So until then, take care of yourselves. Cheers.